Eric is a recent PhD from Duke University. His dissertation was titled Georges Sorel, Autonomy and Violence in the Third Republic. He has a manuscript in preparation deriving from that, which is called Autonomy and Violence, Georges Sorel and the Problem of Liberalism. He's currently visiting assistant professor in history at Kansas State University. He has published on Sorel in the Proceedings of the Western Society for French History and has an article forthcoming, quote, Liberalism and Rationalism at the Revue de Métaphysique et de Morale, 1902 to 1903 in French Historical Studies. His paper today is entitled Disagreeing with Bergson, Baptiste Jacob, Rationalism and Its Bodies. And this developed from the French Historical Studies article but went way off in new directions. So I present Eric to you right now. Thank you.
Thank you for that very kind introduction. It did indeed go off in new directions, I hope not too far away, but this is something of an experiment for me. Baptiste Jacob died in 1909 in Paris at around 50 years old, a victim of chronic lung and stomach ailments. Célestin Bouglet, a longtime friend and fellow philosopher, arranged for the publication of a book of his letters. As an indication of the body of work that Jacob would have accomplished had his help alone. The book, and through Jacob, and through him, the whole philosophical establishment, was the target of a brutal polemic by Georges Platon in 1912, first in the dissident anti-Semitic journal, L'Independence, and then controversially republished in a publication of the Union we heard about earlier. For Platon, Jacob was a perfect mediocrity, without an original thought in his head, a product of the laïque morale, who reproduced it without having the courage to admit, even to himself, that he could not believe it. Platon accused Jacob of seeing the whole world as a lycée class, to be ranked and disposed of accordingly. Jacob was worth talking about for Platon only because he was in charge of teaching la morale at Sèvres and Fontenay-aux-Roses, that is, to women. This was, Platon said, dangerous and important work, akin to training wild animals. Platon's anti-capitalist anti-feminism saw Jacob as an agent of statist feminism, which essentially meant political support pursued by government jobs for women. And Jacob was a destructive failure, even at that, according to Platon. Compared to the great spiritual guides of earlier centuries, compared to his predecessors, Buisson, Picot, and Darlou, for instance, Platon wrote of this educator of women, Le Dompteur est ici un faible. This paper is not about Platon, although I do take his attack on Jacob as evidence that the latter is worth our time, and I think it's instructive in various ways. In 1897, the Revue de Métaphysique et Morale, which I'm going to say is just the RMM, published a rationalist call to arms from Jacob against Henri Bergson, and in particular his most recent book, Matière et Mémoire. Here today, I'm interested in understanding the meaning of Jacob's strong negative reaction to Bergson. And I'm going to focus on the way the body, this is after all an important part of Bergson's book, its subtitle is an essay on the relation of mind to body or l'esprit. I'm going to think about the way the body appeared and functioned, or did neither of those things. And I'm interested more broadly in how, and this is the part that comes out of the FHS piece, in how French rationalist philosophers thought about, or again specifically did not want to think about, the body. It seems to me that a certain framing of the relationship between the body and human bodies and philosophy did a great deal of work for these rationalist philosophers who sympathized with Jacob and came to dominate the philosophical establishment. And of course, this was a special moment. Reviews of Bergson's book appeared over the course of 1897 and 98, and debate over it was, as we'll see, at least for some, intimately connected with debate over Alfred Dreyfus. It would be easy to get sidetracked and lost in the discussion of body or embodiment in French philosophy more generally, but I want to nonetheless mention some earlier points. One long-term conflict had to do with psychology's status as a kind of philosophy or as a discipline in its own right. So, for instance, the associationist psychology that emerged from Condillac and others in the 18th century remained, in a different form, an important and materialist reference into the 1890s. In contrast, Victor Cousin's introspective eclectic spiritualism, insurgent in the 1820s, old guard by the 1850s, made psychology at once entirely abstract and the royal road, not only to what Jen Goldstein, I think, wonderfully calls the garden variety secular bourgeois self, but to philosophy as such. For Cousin and his followers, the body was specifically abstracted from the rational person, from the truly rational person, to such a degree that attempts at materialist psychology were almost by default, at least at first, subversive. It was, in part, such subversive positivists who founded the Third Republic. And in that sort of group is the ambiguously positivist Théodule Ribot, who, while unambiguously a philosopher, nonetheless gave laboratory or experimental psychology an important place in his journal, the Revue Philosophique, which was the central journal of the Third Republic until it was sort of supplanted by the RMM. In December of 1896, Jacob wrote to a friend that he had just finished reading Ribot's Psychologie des Sentiments. Excellent, he thought. A little too schematic, although it was very long. And then I read another thing, which troubled me greatly. That is, some essays by Bergson in Ribot's journal about memory, which were deeply engaged with just these kinds of brain science laboratory results that Ribot was very interested in. To Xavier Léon, who was the editor of the RMM, in a letter discussing the possibility of publishing an anti-Bergson, Jacob wrote that Bergson's philosophy, if it is legitimate, required one to abandon the whole group of fundamental ideas on which my intellectual life, and perhaps intellectual life in common, is based. These are strong words. Before we confront Jacob's anti-Bergson, though, we had better say a little bit more about what Bergson was up to in Matière et Mémoire. Or at least I'll try to do that. As Jacob saw very clearly, Bergson was moving from a critique of psychology and attendant brain science, which was association, was understood as associationist in some way, to the construction of a new metaphysics. Bergson begins with the doctrine of pure perception of images. Perception, he argues, is virtual action. The body here is the center of action, and only that, just one image among others. Memory, however, cannot be regarded as a variety of internal perception. Although the brain may be described as a repository of reflex and muscle memory of impressive complexity, there can be no question, Bergson says, of parallelism between certain states of the brain and certain memories. Or rather, says Bergson, there's another kind of memory, pure memory, l'esprit itself. Between perception, which takes place in the present in view to action, and pure memory, there is not, this is Bergson, there is not a simple difference of degree, but a radical difference of nature. The body is the point, duration, within which true memory expands into the present, interlacing with action oriented toward the future. Thus, Bergson, the distinction between body and l'esprit ought not to be made in terms of space, but of time. This is the fundamental Bergsonian. Past, the true past, is memory, spirit, and it has no extended existence. It's not in a place. It's not stored anywhere in the brain. The present is above all the state of our body. That's Bergson. And the future is virtual action that could take place, perception. So for Bergson, l'esprit is, as it were, behind or underneath the body, curling up into the spaces of indetermination, opened up by a nervous system complex enough to create a temporal hiatus between stimulus and response. Matière et mémoire was widely reviewed and treated several times in the pages of the RMM. Particularly important for us is the review by Victor Delbos, who was a scholar of Spinoza. Delbos was respectful and sympathetic, although in the end he rejected Bergson's attempt to ontologize psychology. Delbos sort of suggests, surely the individual mind, the individual human mind is the place where we ought most to distrust immediate experience. Right? That's not without political connotation at that moment. Delbos argues that Bergson, nevertheless, confirms in a new way the imminence of thought, which is to say modern intellectualism and rationalism, those are the terms. Delbos implicitly links Bergson to Spinoza, both through the notion of the imminence of thought and the Spinozist injunction, which Delbos says Bergson exemplifies, omnis determinatio negatio est, every or all determination is negation. Delbos takes this to mean that one disfigures reality by making determinations. Rather, he says, thought proceeds without such mutilating distinctions through immediate intuition. And this is the real taking hold of itself in its concrete progress, in its undivided and indivisible unity, before the distinct determinations that break it. This is what Jacob rejects most energetically and is sort of enraged by, especially this way of thinking as a form of rationalism. So Jacob sets out with what he himself describes as an unfashionable dogmatism to defend the rationalism and intellectualism that, he will argue, was the common ground on which philosophers as different as Charles Renouvier and Herbert Spencer could in the 1870s agree. That's the framing of his project. Back then, we agreed. Bergson's current popularity, Jacob says, is due not only to his extraordinary talent and style, this is always a backhanded compliment, right? He writes beautifully, but also because his work is the metaphysical expression of the mysticism and impressionism, those are Jacob's words, that define the disquiet, the inquietude of the historical moment. Jacob's rationalism, on the other hand, dusty though it may be, is really the only way forward for philosophy that does not want, as he believed Bergson did, to give up entirely on science. Orienting his polemic around the ideas of continuity, contenu, and becoming, devenir, Jacob argues that Bergson falls into the very same idealist rejection of reality that Hegelian idealism also could not afford. That's Jacob's reference. Distinction, he says, is necessary for thought. It's not simply negation understood as destruction. It is recognition of really existing structure in the world. What was wrong with Hegel, according to Jacob, was that in the end, the dialectical play of negation, in fact implied in omnis determinatio negatio, which is a slogan that Hegel sort of adopted as well, could only end in an extra-worldly absolute, Jacob says for Hegel. Jacob, rather, maintains that, quote, science is the history, externally empirical but at bottom rational, of the universal spirit. This takes place, this places science within history, not beyond it, but not just anywhere in history. Right? Among the faults of Bergson and the new philosophy that he represented was to break with, rather than further, philosophia perennis. That's Jacob's term. Jacob takes tradition very seriously, and he means by this the philosophy that he says took a wrong turn sometime in the 1880s. He's specifically hearkening back to an empirical psychology that could be controlled by a well-founded practice of critique. This for him is Spencer reconciled with Menuhin, itself located politically in the origins of the Third Republic. So Jacob is arguing for a specifically Republican kind of philosophy. And his position, and here I think the politics and the philosophy line up well, is that of someone who's committed to the project of a neo-Kantian, if positivist, republic, but is unhappy about how the synthesis has come to look in 1897. Jacob is incensed that Bergson sweeps aside science by declaring that it is a mere child of practical organic necessity. The practical, Jacob says, must contain something of the true. As he writes, the real is the rational in action. The very originality of concrete and living things appears according to a law. Right? There's reason in development. Development of what? For Jacob, it's the development of the Republic. To follow Bergson would be to retreat into literary navel-gazing, to be convinced that there is no truth to be had in social existence. And for Jacob, the social existence out of which truth comes is very particular, right? It's scientists and philosophers. Georges Platon, with whom I began this paper, was in a sense totally right about Jacob's politics. He really did see the world as a sort of classroom, it seems. Socialism, for instance, which he claimed to be a socialist in the early 1890s, was understood as the really free play of competition. It's not a world without hierarchy, but a world with a true hierarchy, one that corresponds to excellence. Those are practically his words. Right? Jacob was a liberal first, then a Dreyfusard, and only then a Democrat, and maybe a socialist, but a socialist without Marx. So there is a tradition, and thus a sociality, that is a necessary substrate for reason, according to Jacob. The social location does not make reason any less real, universal, or necessary, but rather ensures its progress over time. Here we have, I think, at once the discontinuity that for Jacob is absolutely essential to rationality, and also the kind of devenir, or becoming, that he believes rationalists already comprehended without any help from Bergson. Jacob scrupulously avoided any explicit discussion in print of extra-philosophical consequences that might flow from Bergson's way of thinking. This was a matter of professional tact, but his hostility was transparent. And I think that Bergson is open to the charges that Jacob brought against him of sort of preparing the way for anti-Republican and anti-liberal thinking, right? He was functionally illiberal, polite, personally or socially open. He nonetheless carefully avoided ever taking a stand on the great question of the day, Dreyfus, which was a remarkable feat. Right? In his very openness, he was objectively anti-Republican, some people might say, anti-liberal. Impressionism and mysticism were the most socially loaded terms that Jacob had allowed himself in describing Bergson's philosophy. In a letter to Octave Hamelin, who was his teacher and a great inspiration, in March of 1898, describing in a not uncommon way his profound emotional involvement in the affair, Jacob's close attention to the newspapers, his conviction that Dreyfus is certainly innocent, that in any case, gross illegalities surround the case, he reports special disgust at Millin's appeal to the personal experience of the judge, and lands particularly heavily on one word, the impressions of the judge. So Dreyfus has been condemned, above all, on the impressions of military judges, almost all anti-Semites. Underlines that word and repeats it later on. Not anti-Semites, but impressions. He skates over the anti-Semitism. Okay, to conclude. This paper has used a very particular philosophical event, Bergson's Matière et Mémoire, to explore in a very limited way the function in French philosophy of a very particular topos, the human body. The Dreyfus affair shapes the field of responses, although the conflicts I describe pre-exist the affair. And it nonetheless raises the temperature of these differences, and also itself, I think, pushes into the front issues that are properly epistemological. It concerned what we might call the social distribution of knowledge. These, in turn, are resolved or understood by by at least some actors in corporeal terms. Right? What kinds of bodies can know what kinds of things? What evidence do bodies give? This is a topic in the historiography. Focusing my account on this, I hope, has helped us to think about the relationship between philosophical radicalism, or rationalism, excuse me, and political liberalism at this particular moment. The Bergsonian body authorizes all kinds of responses to the affair. There were Bergsonians on all sides of the affair, right, including disengagement, while the liberal rationalist body, which is never individual, always collective and in part disavowed, mandates at the very least engagement. Jacob's own body, of course, was always failing. He strove, he said, to be stoical. And he experienced a sort of zero-sum game between intellectual production and physical well-being. For example, in 1903, writing to Xavier Léon, he describes how, on doctor's orders, he broke off reading Frédéric Grau's L'Expérience Morale. This is Jacob. It seems to me, anyhow, that I derive a certain physical profit from this complete intellectual inaction. I sleep a little better, and I digest less poorly. Teaching, which he could nonetheless do in a mostly Socratic mode, as long as he did not become overexcited, was not so good. He once lost a whole semester because he'd gotten excited and started coughing, and that was it. In a letter to Léon from February of 1909, he died in April, Jacob is detailing the bad medical situation that he's in and closes the letter. Je tâche d'être aussi philosophe que possible. Though it is maybe hopelessly biographical, I cannot help but wonder if this experience of contradiction between body and thought helped Jacob along in investing himself not in particular works of philosophy, but in philosophy as such, as an institution.